Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Graham Thompson, a political columnist for the Edmonton Journal in Alberta, Canada. A graduate of the University of Waterloo's English Co-op program, Thompson has worked in radio, television and print as a reporter, producer and political writer. Since starting work with the Journal in 1995, he's worked on assignments in various parts of the world, including Russia and Mexico, and has been on two tours with Canadian soldiers in Afghanistan. Thompson has won a National Newspaper Award and a National Brunei Bith Award for Human Rights Reporting. In 2008, he was awarded a Canadian Journalism Fellowship at the University of Toronto's Massey College, where he studied, among other things, environmental law and climate change. Graham Thompson, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the reason I want to interview you very badly is because you wrote a wonderful report that was peer-reviewed for the university. Which university was it?
Toronto,
yes. On carbon capture and storage. And there's a lot of talk about carbon capture and storage, and many people, especially the coal and the oil industry, saying, and the cement industry and the coal tar sands industry, saying, don't worry, we'll just bury the carbon dioxide created by burning fossil fuels under the ground. So we really need to explore that. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and then I just want you to talk and educate us all. But how on earth, Graham Thompson, do you capture carbon dioxide gas coming out of the chimneys of coal-fired plants and then turn it into liquid? What sort of liquid does it become, and how much energy does that use?
Well, yes, those are all very good questions. They have been doing things like this before where they capture carbon dioxide when they do, say, extract natural gas from the ground and it has too much carbon dioxide. There are processes where they can scrub it out of the gas, and they take the CO2 and they compress it into what's called a supercritical fluid. Supercritical fluid has the properties of both a gas and a liquid. So if you put this supercritical CO2 fluid into a container, it would fill all the container like a gas would, but it also is heavy like a liquid.
Is it like dry ice?
It's more like a sort of a combination between a liquid and a fluid. A liquid and a gas. So it's called a supercritical fluid. So it would have properties of both a liquid and a gas.
Yeah.
So this would be under high pressure. Now, the idea is, in carbon capture, the idea is, we're emitting all the CO2 into the atmosphere. That's contributing to climate change, global warming. So the question is, how do we reduce our emissions of CO2? And the easy, simple answer, I guess you could say it, is just as opposed to the difficult things are doing things like solar and wind energy, which are very expensive, and we are burning a lot of coal, we burn a lot of oil, burn a lot of natural gas. So if our economy relies on coal and gas and oil, how do we keep on burning these fuels without constantly emitting more CO2? And the answer that people have come up with is to capture the CO2 at the point source, like a coal-fired plant, power plant, take the CO2, compress it into a liquid, put it in a pipeline, and inject it deep underground. Mm. And in that way, it's an easy solution for the politicians and the oil companies to say that we can, therefore, have our cake and eat it too.
It's kind of greenwashing.
Yes. And so what it is, it's a way of, the term clean coal, you may have heard the term clean coal. This is what one of the genesis of the term clean coal comes from. The coal is not really, it's never really clean.
No.
It's just that the emissions that you get out of the coal, you capture them and you compress them and put them underground. And it takes a lot of energy to do this.
Like how much? How much energy compared to what you're getting out of the coal fire plant?
So it means like 30 to 40% more energy to actually do all the compression.
Right.
So that means you've got to build bigger coal-fired plants because you need the energy, the extra energy to do the compression, and then you're going to transport it and put it underground. So this is an idea that's come forward because a lot of jurisdictions, like Canada, for example, in the U.S., also Australia, where if you've got large coal-fired plants or you're burning a lot of oil, it's a way of continuing to do this, and then you've got a so-called solution. Now, there are about four big pilot projects in the world doing this technology in different stages, different levels. There's one in Norway, for example, where they are taking carbon dioxide from a natural gas field. They're taking the natural gas out of below the surface. They're stripping out the excess CO2 and then pumping it back down into what's called a saline aquifer deep under the ocean.
How do they get the CO2 out of the natural gas?
Well, that's well documented how they can do that. They can strip it out. I couldn't explain to you the actual process of doing that, but that is being done. That's been done for decades. The big issue here is how do they do it in one continuous cycle from a coal-fired plant into the ground? No one's actually done that at a commercial scale.
Mm.
They've done it at small scale. They've done it in experiments. But the trick is here, likely the biggest, the industry that might benefit the most from carbon capture would be coal-fired plants, because they are such big emitters. Plus, it's relatively easy to capture the effluent because it comes from like a single chimney or a big superstack.
Mm.
It's very difficult to capture CO2 from all the cars in the world, obviously. So if you go to a single big emitting source, like a coal-fired plant, then you can strap on scrubbers, get the CO2 out, then you compress it, put it underground. But no one's actually done it at a commercial scale. And so when I was doing my research for this paper for the University of Toronto, I realized what's happening here is that even though there are some experimental things going on in the world, no one is doing it at large scale. No one's even doing it from a coal-fired plant.
Oh, really?
They're trying to do it at very small scales. There's one plant in Germany, for example, where they were hoping to be the very first coal-fired plant in Germany, the world actually, to take the CO2 from the smokestack, capture it, compress it underground. And it turned out that people in the area did not want the CO2 put underground, and they have yet to make that project work because of public
opposition,
perception. This is a real problem, public concern. And it's coined a new term called NIMBY, not under my backyard.
Oh, yes.
So what's happening here is that people are getting kind of concerned, saying, okay, fine, what happens when you put all this stuff underground? And we don't know. There are, let's say, relatively small plants going on. The pilot projects, you've got one in Canada, in Saskatchewan, where they're pumping about a million tons of carbon dioxide underground every year. But the scale that we need to do carbon capture and storage at a world level, we'll need to be doing billions of tons of CO2 a year, billions of tons. So the average coal-fired plant puts out maybe 4 or 5 million tons of CO2 a year. We'll have to be putting underground around the world 10, 15 billion tons a year. It is mind-boggling. The scale is incredible.
And how far underground do they want to inject it, Graham Thompson?
Well, they're saying over 1 kilometer underground.
That's a long way.
Yeah, and what they're saying, And what they want to do is that the best place to put this, they figure, is what's called saline aquifers. These are salt water aquifers deep underground. They're like, imagine porous rock. Imagine a rocky sponge. And they basically they're full of salt water, and they're deep underground. And the idea then is to pump the CO2 underground every year, you know, for dozens, if not centuries of years, and then hope it stays down there. And the problem is that nobody knows what will happen to the CO2 underground over long term. We're talking here billions of tons underground for centuries, and you keep on pumping more and more and more. And like, this is not like for a few years. This is like we're talking decades, centuries doing this.
Yeah.
And so what happens is nobody knows what will happen to this underground long term. Now, the CO2, when it reacts with the water, will form carbonic acid. It's relatively weak acid, but that could, over centuries, start eating away at the rock.
Yes.
That's the problem. Another problem is... what happens if there's a fault in the area? Another issue is, especially in North America, we've got a lot of old oil wells, holes drilled into the ground, and that's potentially a problem if you've forgotten where one of those holes are, and you put all the stuff underground, it comes popping back up through an old oil well. So you've got all kinds of potential safety issues if the CO2 was to start leaking into groundwater.
So if it leaks into groundwater and people are using that groundwater for drinking water and it's a weak carbonic acid, well, I suppose that could dissolve other elements and heavy metals within the Earth's crust and then pollute the drinking water, right?
Yes, exactly. People will argue that, you know, that putting CO2 underground, well, big deal. It's just like getting Perrier water back, right? The thing is, first of all, the effluent from the coal-fired plant could very well contain things like mercury and other pollutants from the smokestack.
Yeah.
And then you're right. When you put this carbonic acid underground, it could potentially start to leach out of the ground things like arsenic, elements like that. And then if that migrates into the your drinking water, you get a real problem.
Oh, yeah.
Another issue, and it's not just a matter of that, you can also, if you're pumping the CO2, this fluid CO2 into the aquifers, that will displace that salt water. And that could potentially be displaced into your drinking water. So it's really important, if they're going to do this, that they do this properly and pick the site really carefully. Because if they don't, people are going to be in a lot of trouble. So that's part of the issue here is how do they do it? Where do they put it? And politicians, though, and I know I can speak for North America, are telling us this is the answer. In my province of Alberta, Canada, the politicians are saying that we will be 70% of our target for CO2 emissions will be done through carbon capture sequestration. 70%, 140 million tons a year, they figure here, but nobody knows that they can do it. Not even the scientists who are working with the government can give that guarantee. The politicians are making these guarantees, making it sound like this is a proven technology. It will work at large scale. It will work large scale over long term. And there's not a scientist that I'm aware of on the planet that knows it will work at a large scale over long term.
Yeah.
That even those who believe in carbon capture are saying, we need more time to study this.
Well,
go on. Go ahead.
Well, I've heard it'll take up to 2030 to have any effective impact at all, if it indeed is going to have an impact.
Yes. It will take probably 20 years to see if this technology can work.
By which time, you know, the level of CO2 in the atmosphere might have risen to 450 parts per billion. And by which time the temperatures could rise 2 degrees centigrade.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem.
We've had it.
I think it's a very good point, and I've mentioned in my paper that carbon capture sequestration, you know, I think that the scientists have shown it could work. It can work at a small scale over a small time frame. But we don't know what happens in 20 years if we've been doing on experiments and this does not work or it's causing some real problems. Then what's the plan B?
Yeah.
And so there are environmentalists in Canada saying, well, look, you know, we can use this carbon capture as a an interim step. Fine, let's put some stuff underground, but let's not stop looking for other answers. And I think the danger with carbon capture is it does, according to the politicians' language, it tends to lull us into a false sense of security.
Yeah, yeah.
It was found a solution. And I know in Canada, you know, the politicians say, well, look, we are looking at other issues of wind power and solar power. But you look at the actual, their actual language tends to gravitate back towards carbon capture and storage because it's an answer to fossil fuel burning economies can rely on it to keep on burning fossil fuel.
Well, and I've been in Alberta. I've met your energy minister. What's his name, Wright?
McKnight.
Yeah, Knight.
Yeah, Knight.
Well,
yeah, sorry,
I have to tell you that I was singularly unimpressed in that he was not a scientist. He really actually didn't know what I was talking about when it came to nuclear power, let alone global warming. And the truth is that most politicians are not scientists, that they are in the back pockets of the coal companies, particularly in Alberta with the coal tar sands and all the rest. And it seems to me that Alberta is a perfect province to set up massive wind farms and solar power on every house and solar thermal plants. That would employ hundreds of thousands of people, increase the GDP. I mean, these politicians, I have to say, don't seem to be extremely bright.
Well, I think, you know, you've got, I think Alberta is caught in a conflict, though. I think that this is a province that relies on oil and gas.
I know.
And so I think that the politicians aren't going to be the ones. It'd probably be political suicide to say that we want to move away from oil and gas. I think what's going to happen here, Helen, is that the leadership will come from without. It's not, it won't come from within Alberta.
From the people.
It'll come from, I think it'll come from well, potentially from the U.S. See, Alberta's not really going to act unless Ottawa acts. And Ottawa is not going to act unless Washington acts.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got our federal environment minister, Jim Prentice, said last week that Canada isn't going to do anything major on the climate change front until they hear from Washington, because our economy is so intertwined with the Americans that Canada doesn't want to do anything to create problems for our economy until it sees what the Americans are going to do. So we're all, in a sense, waiting on Washington to do something.
And, you know, and we might kill the world for money.
Well, I think, to me, it's more like, you're right, it's money, it's also politics. It's politics. People, I think, deal in self-interest. That's very much a human nature issue. And if people don't see the people want to, I think, help the environment. They want to do the right thing. But if you have politicians telling them that if they, you know, cut back or if governments impose limits on carbon emissions or bring in a carbon tax, that will kill jobs, then people are more reluctant then to actually make steps. And I think the problem is politicians are frightening people, I think, into thinking that it's either the economy or the environment. And I think that they are leading us, to me, down the wrong path by frightening people. Especially in Alberta, the sense that people who are pushing more things like a carbon cap and trade or a carbon significant carbon tax are actually seen as enemies of Alberta and enemies of Canada, which is unfair.
Well, yeah, but I found Alberta a really queer place, I have to say. I've never met so many global warming skeptics. It's sort of the land of the Flat Earth Society.
I know you're right. A lot of people here are in denial about climate change, global warming. There are a lot of them here who think it's a hoax. It's a UN-inspired hoax.
Yep.
It's a way to try and take money from Alberta.
Yep.
But I think that the province, even the province that the government here is trying to spend, or hoping to spend, or saying it's going to spend $2 billion in carbon capture. And I guess it's sort of a no-win situation here politically. On the one hand, people like groups like Greenpeace are saying carbon capture sequestration is the wrong way to go. It's a dead end. This isn't going to work. So you're wasting $2 billion. At the same time, the deniers are saying, well, climate change is a complete hoax, and we shouldn't be spending $2 billion.
Yes.
So you have the government, in a sense, pleasing nobody here. And on this weird situation, you've got the deniers and Greenpeace agreeing that it's a waste of money to spend $2 billion on carbon capture. Now, of course, Greenpeace would argue it's good to spend that money on alternate energy and finding ways of economizing and finding ways of conserving energy. But it's an odd problem. It's partly because of our political heritage, our culture here. And also, I think it's because people here depend on oil and gas so much. People's jobs depend on it.
Yes,
and people
I know,
moving
but
here.
I've just commissioned a report in the United States, and you can download it at ieer.org, called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, and examining all the available renewable technologies and conservation, America can be carbon-free and nuclear-free by 2050. And there's absolutely no doubt about it. It's been costed out. It's quite a technical report. It's been seen by Nancy Pelosi and Ed Markey in the Congress. Utah, the state of Utah and Texas are using it. So for there to be any doubt at all that renewable energy can solve the problem is just ridiculous. It's like saying we don't have bones in our skeleton or we don't have a blood supply or something. It's absolutely doable right now, and the jobs will be enormously profitable, and there'll be millions of jobs in time. So to deny that side of reality with all these myths and legends that are being created is, for me as a scientist and a doctor, really a bit sociopathic.
Well, I think that you won't see leadership on this issue come out of a coal-fired or fossil-based economy or oil-based economy. The leadership on this issue is not going to come out of this because the politicians are caught in a conflict. They want to keep being reelected, and they're not going to go out there and say to people, stop using oil and gas. So if you want leadership, you can't get it from, a fossil-based economy. Alberta's calling itself a leader on things like carbon capture, but that, to me, is, first of all, they're not actually doing anything on carbon capture. They're talking a lot about it. So even if you believe this is the way to go, the Alberta government's announced two different projects in the last month or so, but that's just talking about potentially doing this in the next year or two. They're not actually spending any money right now on it. But it does give them some cover when they go to international conferences. They can say, yes, we're going to spend $2 billion on carbon capture pilot projects. And in fact, all they're doing right now is promising to talk to companies about doing this perhaps in 2 or 3 years. And even then, it wouldn't start working for years down the road. It's also it'd be a very expensive technology as well. But if I go back to my original point, and that is this gives politicians cover to say, we've found a solution. Some people don't, yes, you can conserve, but we can then keep on burning oil and gas and coal, and this isn't going to be a problem.
Right. It's like an alcoholic drinking alcohol and saying, it's not going to damage my liver. I'm not going to get cirrhosis. I'm not going to get Wernicke's encephalopathy and Korsakoff syndrome, and I'll keep drinking. Or it's like a smoker. Haven't I heard that so many times from my patients? Yes, I can't stop smoking. And when they're 43, they get lung cancer. It's a similar sort of attitude, I think. And I'm interviewing Graham Thompson, who's a political journalist for the Edmonton Journal in Alberta, Canada. I go back to politicians again, Graham. If there was someone like Pierre Trudeau or Lester Pearson, and I did spend a couple of hours with Pierre Trudeau and actually convinced him to do the Five Continents, Six Nations Peace Initiative. If there was a real leader in Edmonton who could inspire people for the highest good and to altruism and to care about their children, they could in fact establish a wonderful wind energy system in Alberta and a solar system. They could do it. It's absolutely possible, but you have to inspire, teach, and educate people, which is what you're doing, of course.
Well, I think, and Alberta's going to argue that, of course, they are doing wind power. we do have wind power plants, especially in southern Alberta. But of course, in the north is where the money is. But that's the oil sand.
Yeah.
And that the money and money talks. So you're talking, you know, well over $100 billion in investment from various multinational companies coming into Alberta and building plants to take oil out of the oil sand. So, yes, even though we are building wind farms in Alberta, the money still is in the oil sands. It still is in the conventional fossil fuels. So I think, again, Alberta understands. Alberta knows that the world's looking at Alberta with growing skepticism
concern
about our environmental
yes.
record because of Greenpeace has done a really good job of actually spotlighting the oil sands or the tar sands.
They're
in
disgusting.
Alberta.
That oil sand stuff is absolutely disgusting. So boiling the sand to get the oil out and then sending it down to America to burn it into cars to create more global warming. It's a terrific idea.
Well, another, speaking of that, another issue with carbon capture and storage is a sort of a parallel issue that comes on, and that's called enhanced oil recovery. And one thing that they have been using fluid CO2 in the past 20 years or so is you take compressed CO2, put it into old oil fields, and then that pressure helps you eject more oil.
Yeah.
It's called enhanced oil recovery.
Yeah.
And so you've got governments now, especially in Canada, saying, well, look, you know, what we can do is that we can sequester, we can put CO2 into the ground, and therefore it is sequestered in the ground and good for us. But we can use that as well to then squirt more oil out of old depleting oil fields. And so it's called enhanced oil recovery. And so my argument is that that's not really carbon sequestration, because if your goal is to get your carbon out of the air and put it underground, if you're just doing that to get more oil out, then all you're doing is then burning that oil and producing more CO2.
Correct.
So the governments, though, tend to label enhanced oil recovery the same thing as carbon capture and sequestration.
Yeah.
In fact, it's not. No. In fact, the difference is, though, there's a monetary reward. By putting CO2 under the ground to get more oil, you're making money. Putting CO2 under the ground, just putting it under the ground and say into a saline aquifer, costs a lot of money, and there's no payback. You're putting it under the ground, and the payback is you're getting carbon out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, we're addicted to money too, like alcoholism. Now, I just want to ask you several more questions, Graham. When you inject fluid CO2 underground, does it then re-expand into CO2 gas? Number one. Number two, can it create earthquakes? And I've read that it can. And number three, I've read that there can be, and I think this happened in Africa somewhere, suddenly there's an enormous burp of carbon dioxide, like masses of it, out of a crack in the Earth's crust that could actually asphyxiate many, many people if they're living in that area.
Okay, so let's start with the first one. What was your first question again?
It was, does the fluid...
The gas. And that goes back to the issue about how deep do you put the CO2. CO2, if you put it below 800 meters underground, will remain in that supercritical compressed state.
Oh.
If it's below 800 meters, it will stay in that supercritical state. Now, the thing about that state, though, that sort of that fluid state, is that it's more buoyant than water. So putting it into a saline aquifer, it will want to go to the surface. It will try to escape.
Mm.
So if you have any sort of cracks or faults, it will try to escape. It is not heavy. Not heavier than water, so it will try to escape, but it is in that supercritical state, which of course means, though, that if it does find a way up, it will start then to expand.
Yes.
And expand more and more as it reaches towards the surface. And what was your second question?
The second question is, can injecting those millions of tons of CO2 underground initiate earthquakes?
Yeah, these are called microseismic events. In fact, some reports saying that pressure buildup caused by CO2 injection could trigger small seismic events. That's been shown in the past. You know, when they have put CO2 under the ground in the past, it does do these very small seismic events. Now, these are not big earthquakes, but what they could potentially do is cause a crack. and those cracks could then allow the CO2 to escape.
Okay, so the next question is, what about a big burp that could asphyxiate populations living nearby?
Yeah, you're talking about the there was an issue in Cameroon in Africa
yes.
in 1986. I think more than 1,000 people were killed. This was a people living in sort of a mountainous region. There was a lake. At the bottom of the lake was a sort of natural CO2 buildup. And that actually caused this burp of naturally occurring CO2 to erupt towards the surface. And then that then asphyxiated over 1,000 people who were sleeping in their villages around the lake.
So that's now, a side effect that could happen.
Yeah. Now CCS is not poisonous on its own, but what it can do is it displaces the oxygen, and then that will asphyxiate you.
Yeah.
And that was what happened in 1986. It was Lake Niles in Cameroon.
Mm.
1,700 people, 1,700 were killed. Now, so this is the question put to the engineers looking at these, the carbon sequestration projects. Now, their response is that kind of thing is almost impossible to happen because it wouldn't be a giant bubble of CO2 sitting underground. It would be the CO2 in the pore space of, imagine, this sort of big sponge underground, this rocky sponge. The CO2 would be spread into the pore space. But if there was a leak, it wouldn't be a catastrophic big eruption like a gigantic burp happening. It would be more like a slow leak.
But they don't really know, do they, Graham? It's all conjecture.
Well, at this point, you're right. Like could a blowout happen? Yeah, a blowout
could
happen.
That's right. It could.
Now, but I think what I'm saying here is that the experts who say it will work and think it can work say that a blowout like that is very highly unlikely. And now their argument, of course, is that it's better to do carbon capture sequestration than not do it because right now we're putting all our emissions into the air. So they're thinking if we want to keep on burning fossil fuels, this is the answer. Put it underground. There are risks involved, but it's less risk than climate change.
Yeah, but this is ridiculous because the truth is, according to James Hansen and the climate change people, we have to stop burning coal. We have to stop it because that's the most concentrated form of carbon, producing the most carbon dioxide in the world, and we have to stop it. We can't say, oh, well, we'll do this and we'll do that. It's like stopping a cancer. You have to cut it out.
Yeah, and I think the thing is here, there's a cost involved, right? There's a price. And how do you tell China, which is building, dozens of coal-fired plants a year, like how do you tell them to stop burning coal? Because you got China and India now moving into the fossil fuel economy.
Yeah, well, I know that, but India and China can be powered. I mean, every little house can have a solar cooker. Every house can have a solar panel collecting electricity. Solar hot water systems, solar thermal systems can be built, particularly in China and India, where it's very hot. And I know that Obama, at the moment, as we tape this interview, is meeting with Hu, the Chinese leader. And apparently there is some breakthrough because Copenhagen is coming up, the conference on global warming. And everyone had really thrown up their hands and said, we won't achieve anything because financially it's not going to happen and the like and the like. Apparently there are some breakthroughs between China and America, the two major countries actually that have to move and act, whereby something might happen. We're talking about, it's a mobilization for war, really. It's war against the fossil fuel manufacturers because when America entered the Second World War late, such was the impetus to fight Germany that within 6 months, every single factory in America had been converted to making tanks, planes, guns, ships, you name it, within 6 months. That's the sort of urgency that we require, and not all this sort of rationalizing and postulating and posturing And the bottom line, as you've kept saying, Graham Thompson, is money. Are we really, and I'm speaking now as a pediatrician, you know, trying to practice global preventive medicine, are we going to kill the earth and 30 million other species with it for money? And it really comes down to that. And the point is that the planet is in the intensive care unit right now. And we are really theoretical physicians to a dying planet. And it's like, you know, I could have a patient in the ICU and say, well, look, it's 3 a.m, I'm tired, I'm going to bed, you know. And anyway, I'm not making much money by looking after this patient. The patient will die. And I think that it's imperative that, and I know that you understand this, Graham Thompson, that people understand the absolute imperative urgency of the situation we face right now. Would you like to comment?
I think the problem is people, I don't think, understand the urgency.
No, they don't.
That's the problem. That's why politicians aren't acting.
Yeah.
That's why politicians in North America with the fossil-based economies are not saying what you're saying, because, you know, they're saying, well, gee, you know, some of them are saying the science is still not convincing enough. There are a lot of deniers among the politicians, especially in the fossil-based fuel economies. And you have a lot of people not really sure if, in fact, it's real. And, in fact, I think that the analogy to the Second World War is a good analogy, except people don't see the Nazis, you know, in terms of, like, they don't see the climate change being that dire. No one has proven it to them. No one has convinced them. And there's still that doubt. And there's a very effective denial machinery out there.
Propaganda. It's a propaganda campaign. They're using the same PR firms that the tobacco companies use
to inject
doubt into, does smoking really cause cancer? And it's brilliant and it works. And it really is wicked. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I think it's evil, because it means absolute destruction.
What they're doing is they don't have to prove climate change doesn't exist.
Yep.
They just have to prove this doubt.
Yep.
And they put doubt in people's minds, and people say, well, gee, you know, do we really have to do the big push like they did in 1939, 1941? Because, gee, you know, that would be hard to do. It's changing my lifestyle. It's difficult. It's expensive. Do I have to do that when I got this guy over here telling me it's all a hoax? Shouldn't we wait? And then what's going to happen is people will end up waiting. And also, I think fueling that, so to speak, that sense of dithering, perhaps, is this reliance on carbon capture and storage as the solution. So people are being fed, I think, something that this, in fact, is the big solution.
It's like taking apricot pits for cancer.
I once had
a patient with leukemia, a child, and the parents took him to this charlatan, and they buried him up to his neck in manure. He died. It's... I know that's a funny analogy, but it strikes me as appropriate. Does that take your breath away?
it is. It's sad, I think, the fact that so much confusion is being spread by people who are not scientists, who are, I think, maybe doing it for their own ends. And I think that there's a lot of scientists, of course, credible scientists, who say this is a real problem that we're facing here.
But the thing is,
you have credible scientists who believe in man-made climate change, who also believe in carbon capture and storage.
They
think this is the way to go because it's a practical solution that will get the oil companies and coal companies on board.
Mm.
And I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying that there's a lot of questions about this that are not being raised by politicians. Politicians are giving us these lines. This is a proven commercial size scale that we can actually do this, when there's a lot of scientists saying, well, hold on for a second. No, we don't know if this will work at a commercial large scale to actually do any good. And if let's say, in 20 years, realize, oops, a dead end, then we're really hooped.
Yeah, then we're really
in a real
hooped.
Problem.
It's like the scientists, too, who are worried about global warming, saying, well, nuclear power's the answer. It's the same sort of confusion of a rational mind, I think.
And well, I think people right now are looking for answers, right?
Yeah.
And there is no simple answer. There's no easy answer. Carbon capture and storage gives people the illusion it's the simple answer, but there is no answer.
You see, there is a simple answer with this roadmap for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future. The technology is here. It's relatively inexpensive. Now, Denmark gets 20% of its electricity from wind now. Spain is leading the world in solar thermal. Germany's leading the world. It's absolutely doable, and it would increase the GDP and increase employment. I suppose I'm talking like a physician, because if you've got a patient who's dying and there's some treatments that are nasty, that have side effects, you have to convince the patient that this is the way to go, otherwise they will die. And I think that's a similar analogy.
Right, and I think people have not been convinced.
Well, it's up isn't it, to convince
them.
Well,
I think, and I live in a fossil fuel economy. Yeah. It's very difficult. People up here see it as a threat to their jobs. But I think people, if they're given a realistic answer, that they will do the right thing.
Yes. Well, I would invite you, Graham Thompson, to read Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, to download it from IEER.org. Okay. And I would like you to give us your webpage and the way to get to your wonderful study on carbon capture and storage done for the University of Toronto.
Well, if you just go on Google and search the Program on Water Issues. So Program on Water Issues Toronto. You'll get the webpage for the Program on Water Issues, and there you can download my report on carbon capture and sequestration.
Wonderful. Well, look, I know you have to go and do another interview now. I thank you so much, Graham Thompson, for appearing on If You Love This Planet. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the audience has learned as much.
A pleasure and an honor talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Graham Thompson, a political columnist for the Edmonton Journal in Alberta, Canada. Now, on If You Love This Planet, I'm going to play an interview with William Pitt, which I conducted as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. William Pitt is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author of two books, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, and The Greatest Sedition is Silence. His newest book, House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation, is now available from Polly Point Press. So from the Pacifica Radio Archives, please enjoy this discussion between myself, Helen Caldicott, and William Pitt. I want to introduce Mr. William Pitt, who is a commentator, an author, and someone who is extremely important to the world situation at the moment, because I believe you, Mr. Pitt, have written and studied extensively on the project for a new American sanctuary.
That is correct.
So can you give us the history of this? When did these ideas start taking place? What was the gestation of it? And who's involved? And what does it actually say?
Well, to a certain extent, it's a bit of a long story, because the Project for the New American Century is a hardcore right-wing think tank out of Washington, D.C. These things tend to metastasize from one think tank to another. The godfather of them all, of course, is the American Enterprise Institute.
Who funds the American Enterprise Institute?
A number of conservative businessmen.
Olin, Scaife?
Yeah, it's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
The Project for the New American Century began in about 1997, and the organizing principle behind it was that the United States, the sole remaining superpower, was not doing nearly enough to vigorously export the American model of democracy to the rest of the world, particularly by force of arms when the case was required. In 1997, they began actively agitating for war on Iraq to begin this process of exporting the American model of democracy into the Middle East.
Who are they? Who are the main players?
Well, that's sort of the core issue here. These are the guys who put the Iraqi Liberation Act before Congress and got it signed. They've been funding the Iraqi National Congress. They've written white papers about attacking Iraq, taking the place over, and then using it as a military staging area to attack regimes like Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. A guy named Norman Podhoretz, who's a writer affiliated with them, described the whole process as the reformation and the modernization of Islam. Now, what makes these guys troubling, I mean, you know, wacky right-wing think tanks are a dime a dozen in Washington, but the fellows on the signatories list for the Project for the New American Century, the guys who wrote the papers, came up with the ideas, and believe in everything that's being said here. Dick Cheney, Vice President. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. Paul Wolfowitz, Assistant Secretary of Defense. Richard Perle, the former chairman of the Defense Policy Board and still a very major player within the administration. I. Lewis Libby, who is Cheney's top advisor. And a guy named Bruce Jackson, who is the chairman of Project for the New American Century. Came from Lockheed Martin. And as if my memory serves me, it was Bruce Jackson who wrote the foreign policy part of the 2000 GOP platform, which, by the way, called for the elimination of Saddam Hussein even before George W. Bush was the nominee.
Yeah, it was Bruce Jackson.
Okay.
What drives them, Mr. Pitt? Is it what's their psychology? What are their fundamental principles? What lies behind the psyche of these characters?
Well, if you go to their website, and it's all right there in black and white, newamericancentury.org, they have a white paper that they came out with in 2000 called Rebuilding America's Defenses, which, by the way, was pretty much taken part and parcel and used as the template for Bush's 2002 reorganization of our foreign policy in that report that he put out in September 2002. My take on it more than anything else is that they are looking to westernize parts of the world that are not particularly fond of or interested in Western culture. Part of that is purely ideological. The American way is the only way. It's the best way. Part of it is cutting out the middleman between our businesses and our economy and certain resources and markets. Used to be we used to use diplomacy to get to the oil or get to a market that we were interested in. Now we'll merely cut out the middleman, install a regime there that seems pro-Western but is not really democratic, and will repress the local indigenous culture.
But America's been doing that for a long time, because Hussein has been employed by the CIA since he was 21, and he got rid of a man who was the prime minister or president, Qassam, in a bloody coup, and then eventually his Ba'ath Party came to power, but it was all orchestrated in a way by the CIA. So the CIA's been doing this for a long time.
Sure, the CIA has been doing it for a long time, and in that aspect, I think you could argue that that whole involvement with Saddam Hussein was very much part and parcel with Cold War gamesmanship, dealing with Iran and the rest of that region. There is no Cold War anymore.
Right.
You know, there is a war on terror, depending on your definition of whatever the hell that means.
Yes.
But there is no huge, massive, centralized enemy with which we have to deal with. And, you know, certainly the CIA and other entities within the government were playing fast and loose with the rules throughout, you know, a great deal of history between now and World War II. But we also used a lot of diplomacy. You know, we didn't make up reasons to go and invade countries and smash regimes just because we wanted to gain a foothold in a territory. You're certainly right that we've done this type of thing before, but this is a much more hyperactive version of the kind of thing that we've done in the past, and in a time period where it's a lot more dangerous to be playing these kind of games.
It's Wild West mentality, isn't it?
Exactly. What we're dealing with is a bunch of very frightening far-right-wing extremists who spent 3 years or 4 years on the fringes writing white papers about using the military to spread their breed and their version of American democracy across the globe. If you read their documentation, Rebuilding America's Defenses, you'll see one of the four absolutely required line items in all of this is not to be prepared to fight several major theater wars, but to fight several major theater wars so that they will A, get their footholds where they want them, and B, get the rest of the world to sit up and pay attention. Now, nobody expected guys like Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Perle to ever come within 1,000 miles of power. They've just always been considered to be on the far fringes, and that was where they had been relegated, and that was where everybody expected them to be, just toiling away on these fanciful, wild-eyed, new American century empirical ideas. And ever since the 2000 election, we've found ourselves in a situation where the inmates are running the asylum. The Project for the New American Centuries, all of their wild and crazy white papers about using the military to spread their breed of American democracy has become standard American foreign policy, and the United States media is rolling along with it.
Why is the media rolling along with it?
Because to a certain extent, we're dealing with a situation where a lot of them are along for the ride. You think about NBC, MSNBC, and CNBC, three of the largest news distributors in the country, they're owned by General Electric.
Hmm.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but General Electric gets paid every time we go to war somewhere. They build the wiring in the airplanes and the bombs.
And the missiles and the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power plants. Well, how do you define Murdoch?
He might as well have a position in the Republican National Committee. He's not a journalist, and neither is anybody who works for his stations.
Well, he once was very liberal. He used to promote me in his major newspaper in Australia in the early 70s, and then something happened to him, so I don't understand.
I don't understand the kind of sort of spiritual metastasization that you could go through to wind up putting forward the kind of rhetoric and the kind of fake journalism.
Yellow journalism.
It's barely yellow. It's I don't know what it is, but it is
purient.
Just poor and not the truth and not accurate and not representative of reality.
No.
And journalism once upon a time was supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I'll tell you one other little anecdote. One of the reasons, and I'm not calling anybody a Nazi by saying this, but it is a telling bit of history, that one of the main reasons why the rest of the world did not get hip to Germany's rampant militarization in the mid to late 30s was because the media at that time, newspapers and radio, were owned by chemical and steel companies that were making a mint off of Germany's ramped up militarization. And only when it became too late did the world find out exactly what was going on in Germany and what their plans were. My point being is when you have a media that is compromised by financial considerations, you don't have a media, you have spokespeople.
I agree. They're stenographers.
That is deadly, deadly poison.
Now, tell me, what role do you think Israel plays in the thinking of the people that you just named who are behind the Project for a New American Century, particularly in the Middle East?
Well, to a certain extent, that's about the most insidious part of trying to approach this and deal with it in terms of taking these projects for the New American Century people to task, because in the progressive end of the political spectrum, on the liberal end, there's a rather large rift right down the middle between people who support Israel and people who do not support Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem here is that you cannot talk about the Project for the New American Century without talking about Israel, because a lot of these PNAC guys really honestly believe that they are defending Israel by wiping out every regime in that region and by putting the United States in grave danger of reciprocal terrorist attacks by bankrupting our economy, et cetera, ad nauseum, killing thousands and thousands of people. They believe they're doing this to defend the state of Israel. You could get that very easily out of guys like Don Rumsfeld and Richard Perle. They've believed this for years. But when you start to argue along these lines, when you start saying, when you mention Israel, and a lot of people are going to tune you out or get quite angry with you.
Well, so in some of their minds, would you say, like Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and the like, that Israel comes before America?
If you put it to them like that, they would say absolutely not. They would say America comes first.
I'm
America
asking
always
you, though.
Comes first. But I would say that we've put our entire foreign policy onto an apple cart that is really rolling towards a very dangerous precipice. We've already engaged one nation in the region of the Middle East. We're growling at Syria. We flipped a couple of missiles at Iran. Goodness knows where this is going to lead.
Oh, do you think they weren't accidental missiles? Do you think they meant to send those missiles to Iran?
I'm not entirely sure how you could accidentally blow up a government building. They blew up an oil ministry building.
Did they? I didn't know that.
That's a pretty big whoops.
Did they really?
Yeah, that's a well-targeted oops.
Well-targeted cruise missile oops.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that.
They've put the foreign policy of the United States of America into the hands of these New American Century white papers, many of which are geared around the defense of Israel through a process of wiping out every potential aggressor nation in that region. Forget about diplomacy.
Well, how do you think the American people would feel if they really understood that?
I think they'd probably be really scared. If the American people understood exactly, you know, if we could see through the glass darkly and see where this is going to lead a year or 2 years from now. I mean, my goodness, September 11th was born in 1978 when we dared the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan. The process that whole thing initiated gave birth eventually to the Taliban, to Osama bin Laden, and everything from there on out.
Created by the CIA.
Yeah, absolutely. Created by, actually, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
How did they dare the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan? I can't remember.
In 1978, Afghanistan was run by a communist puppet regime of the Soviet Union. And in 78, we began training Mujahideen, Islamic fundamentalist freedom fighters out of Pakistan out of religious schools, the Taliban, to start going after and striking against this communist puppet regime in Afghanistan. We didn't do it. And Brzezinski was quoted in this in a French magazine whose name escapes me in 1998. We didn't do this because we wanted to see this puppet regime fall. We did it because we wanted to scare the Soviets so much about the status of their satellite regime there that they would invade. And in 1979, they did. And they proceeded over the next 10 years to smash that country to pieces.
And lay landmines all over the place.
Landmines everywhere. Millions of people killed. Millions of people internally displaced.
Millions were killed?
I believe so. There were something like 2 or 3 million civilians killed, and millions more internally displaced over the course of that war.
And America was there, too, dropping its landmines.
Well,
its
America was there arming and funding and cheering on the Taliban and the Mujahideen. And then in 1989, when the Soviets finally withdrew, absolutely positively nobody, including the superpower nation that dared the invasion to happen in the first place, came in to help these people put the pieces back together again. So from 89 to 96, there was a wild and crazy civil war where a lot more people got killed. By 96, the Taliban had taken over the country. Now, Osama bin Laden made his reputation in Afghanistan fighting that Soviet war. And the Taliban took him in and made him an honored guest. And the rest is pretty much history. Actions have consequences.
Why did Osama fight the Soviet Union?
Because it was a godless communist regime coming in against a nation with a great many Muslim people. The same reason why he basically declared war on America when we put our troops in Saudi Arabia for the first Gulf War. Because according to the version of Islam that he believes in, it is against the law of Allah to have non-Muslim troops on the soil, on the land of Mecca and Medina.
Yeah, yeah.
So that pretty much teed him off.
Well, America's pulling out of Saudi Arabia, so they say, so Rumsfeld says. I wonder if they'll get them all out.
There's a company in Kuwait. I think they may be in Iraq by now, but they were in Kuwait for the course of the whole war and waiting for it to start, called Kellogg Brown and Root.
Yep.
They're a subsidiary.
That's a Chinese company.
Yeah, they're a subsidiary of Halliburton.
Mm-hmm.
And Kellogg Brown and Root's stock in trade is the building of permanent military bases.
Yep.
Those fellows are going to scuttle on into Iraq after the dust finishes clearing, if it ever does, build us some permanent military bases, like the ones they built Camp Bonesteel and 11 others in the Kosovo area. And those 19,000 troops that are in Saudi Arabia can just scoot on down and jump on into
Iraq.
These brand new bases. And we will have a permanent military presence in Iraq with a Shiite majority that is getting angrier at us by the day.
How many countries now does America have permanent bases? It's up to 100, isn't it?
It's a great many, and it's been increasing dramatically of late.
America's metastasizing its military bases around the world. Thanks so much for filling us in on this whole horrific situation, and which we have to fix.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and that was an interview with William Pitt, which I conducted as part of a 6-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. That's all for today, and we will be talking with you again next week. If you want to look up some programs, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.